Also in our headlines, Iran, Russia, and China tell the UN Security Council that all provisions of Resolution 2231 have ended and triggering of the snapback mechanism is not legal.
Hello and welcome everybody here in the Iranian capital, Tehran. This is World News.
Our top story for this half hour, Israeli forces continue to violate the Gaza ceasefire agreement nearly 2 months after its conclusion, killing and injuring more civilians across the war-ravaged territory. According to local sources, two civilians, including a child, were killed and at least 15 others injured after Israeli artillery fire targeted a house in the Al-Tufa neighborhood of Gaza City. Two more civilians, including a child, were killed and over 20 others, mostly women and children, injured in artillery shelling of Al-Sanafur area and Al-Daraj school east of Gaza City. The school was used as a shelter for displaced people. Gaza's health ministry said the territory's hospitals received 5 bodies on Tuesday, increasing the number of Palestinian civilians killed since the enforcement of the truce to about 360. Among those killed was a Palestinian photojournalist who lost his life in a drone strike on Khan Yunis in southern Gaza. Another journalist was wounded in the same attack since October 2023. The Israeli genocide has claimed the lives of over 70,100 Palestinians, leaving nearly 171,000 others injured. Well, we earlier talked to our Gaza correspondent, Mutiaba Mosabe, to get the latest updates on Israel's ceasefire violations across the war-torn territory. Let's take a listen.
The current situation is beyond catastrophic and tragic for the Palestinian people in Al-Tufah neighborhood, whereas the entire area is still witnessing more cruel and ferocious attacks of the Israeli occupation forces. And as you know, for the second consecutive day, this area in particular is still under the heavy bombings and attacks of the Israeli occupation forces. As you know, the Israeli artillery continued and intensified its attacks against that area, particularly the As-Sanafur junction in Al-Tufah neighborhood, whereas two Palestinian civilians were confirmed killed after the Israeli artillery shells targeted several Palestinian residential buildings in that area. Meanwhile, the Israeli warplanes launched another wave of the destructive and brutal attacks against the eastern side of Khan Yunis City, coupled with the extensive artillery strikes as well. Let me remind you that we are talking about more, at least 5 Palestinian civilians have been confirmed killed since dawn hours till this moment. And this is why today is considered and deemed as another bloody day for the Palestinian people. On the other hand, as you know, we are still witnessing how the humanitarian situation is still worsening severely and conspicuously for the Palestinian people on the ground here, because the Israeli regime is still committed to its reductionist approach regarding the humanitarian supplies allowed into Gaza Strip. They are still preventing the smooth flow of the life-saving materials for the Palestinian people, which definitely exacerbates the suffering of the Palestinian people.
A new report by Palestinian officials in Gaza has revealed that the Israeli regime is waging a bloody war against media workers in parallel to the genocide of Palestinian civilians. According to Gaza's government media office, the regime's forces have so far killed hundreds of journalists to prevent unbiased coverage of their crimes in the war-torn territory. The office noted that during 2 years of their Gaza aggression, Israeli forces have killed 257 media workers. It emphasized that the regime's forces have been targeting journalists in a systematic manner. Condemning the deliberate assassinations of Palestinian journalists, the office called on the International Federation of Journalists, the Federation of Arab Journalists, and other global media institutions to take a clear stance on the regime's crimes. It also held Israel and its Western backers, topped by the United States, fully responsible for the crimes committed against journalists in Gaza. The office called for urgent international efforts to mount pressure on the regime and stop its attacks on media workers in Gaza. Journalist and political commentator Sakina Datu believes that the killing of journalists is part of the Israeli regime's strategy to prevent truthful reporting on the Gaza genocide.
The strategy is quite clear, really. It is about making sure that the truth does not come out, because apart from, you know, killing the internal journalists, Israel has not allowed international journalists or media to be present over there. And from the day one, this was because they do not want anything that they do, the massive killings, the inhumane treatment of Palestinians that we are watching because of these very journalists who are being killed, they want to hide the truth. So 257 journalists killed in Gaza. So it tells you that there is a real strategic way over here to kill the story, as we would say. And that is because the story is that of their brutality. These journalists, a lot of them who have paid the highest price by, you know, being killed, they are the ones who the entire world really should be grateful to, because had it not been for them, none of us would have really realized what happened in the past 2 years. Today, you can see globally, there is an awakening. Even though the bombings are not stopping, killing is not stopping, but Israel is hated so much around the world, and there is an imploding from within. Even within Israel itself, it is imploding. There, all this has become possible only because these journalists in Gaza have put the truth or the reality of what they are facing ahead of even their own lives. It's really commendable, and I think
a Palestinian prisoners' rights organization says Israeli forces have greatly intensified their crackdown on Palestinian civilians in the occupied West Bank since the Gaza genocide started. According to the Palestinian Prisoners Society, about 21,000 Palestinians have been abducted by Israeli forces since October 2023. The society described Israel's abductions in the West Bank as the largest in decades. It noted that abductions have involved serious crimes such as extrajudicial killing of Palestinian civilians. The society said the regime also demolishes the homes of Palestinian prisoners as part of its collective punishment policy against the Palestinian people. Meanwhile, Israeli forces continued their violent raids across the occupied territory. On Tuesday, they raided the home and mourning house of a 17-year-old Palestinian youth who was killed earlier in Al-Khalil. Separately, a young Palestinian man was injured by the regime's forces in the town of Beit Hanina, north of the occupied city of Al-Quds. Local sources said Israeli forces chased several workers near the so-called separation wall and opened fire on them, injuring one worker. Political analyst Robert Fantina says Israel continues committing crimes in the occupied West Bank, knowing that it's immune from accountability due to Washington's support for Tel Aviv.
The West Bank was under siege for years. It's been under occupation for years. But this increase in arrests is just beyond anything that's been done before. Now, the Israeli government is arresting anyone it sees. And, of course, it arrests people without charge. It can hold them indefinitely, again, without charge, without granting them access to legal advice or to families, and holds them in horrendous conditions. Even the Israeli Supreme Court has said that some of those prisons have awful conditions, but the rest of the world certainly says it. So this is Israel, once again, knowing it can get away with anything it wants to. It's immune from accountability because of the U.S. veto in the United Nations mainly. But again, it's demonstrating itself as a criminal regime, a racist, brutal, and completely lacking in justice or respect for human rights or international law. The Israeli forces trying to intimidate the Palestinians in the West Bank to let them know that any resistance whatsoever, however minor, can result in the arrest and the destruction of their homes. It's an intimidation tactic which they've used in the past and are accelerating now. But again, it just demonstrates the lack of morality and the obscenity of the Israeli regime.
Day three of a court hearing between the Direct Action Group Palestine Action and the British government has been held in London's High Court. Palestine Action is challenging the government's banning of the group earlier this year, a move widely criticized as an overreach and an infringement on the right to protest. Said Putazo has the latest.
Today is the third and final day of that judicial review in this court. It's in fact a legal challenge brought by the Direct Action Group Palestine Action against its prescription by the Labour government in July this year. Last month, the judges heard from the representatives of the Palestine Action Group, but today, the final day, the judges are hearing from lawyers representing the Interior Ministry, known to Britons as the Home Office. But here's how we got here.
Set up in 2020, Palestine Action's stated goal is to end global participation in Israel's genocidal and apartheid regime. Its mainly targeted weapons factory, especially those belonging to the Israeli group Elbit Systems. In July this year, activists protesting against Israel's genocidal war on Gaza broke into an Air Force base in southern England, causing, the government claims, more than $9 million in damage to two aircraft. Days later, then-Home Secretary Yvette Cooper declared the group a terrorist entity, effectively making membership or support for the group a criminal offense. The ban took effect in July 5th.
It's a massive, massive overreaction and, frankly, an act of state repression to stop the people from mobilizing in a way that they feel is detrimental to their financial interests.
Seeing this as an attack on their civil liberties, thousands have since come out in a string of rallies, holding up signs reading these words. At least 2,300 have been arrested, more than 200 charged with offenses that carry up to 6 months in prison. Earlier this year, Palestine Action's co-founder, Huda Amouri, requested and won permission for a judicial review of the ban at this court, for the court to see if the ban was lawful, if the Home Office followed the correct procedure before proceeding to proscribe the group. In October, the government tried and failed to block the challenge going ahead. And last month, after days of nationwide sign-holding protests, the judicial review finally began. But at the last minute, Martin Chamberlain, the judge due to hear the legal challenge, was replaced by a panel of three judges without explanation. Two of those replacement judges have links that campaigners say raise the appearance of a conflict of interest.
The case against some of the most formidable foes in the world, the British state, the Israeli state, the weapons industry, these are not people who are going to take this lightly. So it doesn't surprise me that they're willing to sabotage the process.
Dame Victoria, who has familial links to prominent pro-Israel lobbyist and major Labour Party donor Trevor Chin, and the group Quilliam, which has been widely condemned as Islamophobic and for supporting far-right agitator Tommy Robinson. And Justice Jonathan Swift, who dismissed WikiLeaks co-founder Julian Assange's extradition appeal back in 2023, has represented the Home Office, which is the defendant in this judicial review, on more than one occasion.
A judgment is expected at a later date, but if the judges in this court find in favor of Palestine Action, the group could potentially be deprescribed. The charges against its many supporters will have to be dropped, and not only that, it'll be a huge embarrassment for the British government that the pro-Palestine demonstrators in the country accuse of participation in Israel's genocidal war on Palestinians. Saipuriza, London.
Pakistan's defense minister says Muslim countries may need to reassess their approach to the Gaza peace effort, citing repeated ceasefire violations by Israeli forces. The remarks come as regional governments debate how to respond to the shifting situation. Anwar Muhyiddin reports.
Pakistan's defense minister Khwaja Asif has said that Muslim countries should revisit their diplomatic stance on Gaza, arguing that incessant Israeli ceasefire violations have undermined peace efforts. His comments come as several regional governments expressed frustrations over the failure of internationally backed agreements to halt military operations. Officials in Islamabad say any reassessment would aim to push for a more reliable framework that prevents future breaches. The idea of a collective Muslim response has been gaining traction in recent weeks, particularly as the Gaza humanitarian concerns deepen.
Daily ceasefire violations are occurring by the Israeli forces, and Muslim Ummah needs to be united and have one solution with one voice, but they are not raising their voices against the Israelis.
Countries across West Asia have been consulting one another on possible political steps, including coordinated pressure through regional bodies. Observers say the broader question is whether Muslim-majority states can unify around a position strong enough to influence future negotiations. Pakistan's call reflects a wider debate over the limits of current mediation efforts. They point out any new approach would require consensus among key regional actors and a clearer mechanism for enforcing commitments on all sides and a more sustainable political roadmap for Gaza.
What will Israel do? Will it continue to violate the ceasefire? This is an existential question for all the countries who have agreed to this U.S.-backed solution. How long will they allow Israel to kill innocent Palestinian children? No, they will reconsider.
The debate points to a wider re-evaluation underway throughout the Muslim world, suggesting that Gaza's future may hinge on a new coordinated regional strategy that could reshape the way the conflict is addressed. Khanwa Muhyiddin, Islamabad.
Iran, Russia, and China formally informed the UN Security Council that all provisions of Resolution 2231, which endorsed the 2050 nuclear deal, have ended in October 2025. They emphasize the triggering of the resolution's so-called snapback mechanism by Western states is therefore devoid of any legal basis. The three countries made the comments in a joint letter to the UN chief and the Security Council's president. They stressed that the snapback mechanism cannot be applied without completing the dispute resolution mechanism embedded in the nuclear agreement known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. They argued that the United States' 2018 withdrawal from the deal fundamentally altered the mechanism. Also, the European Troika's unilateral restrictions against Iran and failure to meet their commitments have invalidated their claims about Iran's noncompliance, reaffirming that all provisions of Resolution 2231 have expired on October 18th. Iran, Russia, and China said the Security Council must close Iran's nuclear file. The UN Secretary General's report on Resolution 2231 is set to be presented on December 13th.
And that brings us to an end here on this edition of the World News. Do stay tuned, though. Bye.
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
On September 22, 1980, when the Islamic Revolution of the Iranian people was not yet 2 years old, Saddam attacked Iran with the green light from the U.S. Former Iraqi dictator had signed a peace agreement with Mohammad Reza Pahlavi 5 years earlier, which had ended his border disputes with Iran. But just a few days before issuing the order to attack, much like the U.S. president who tore up the JCPOA agreement, he appeared openly and confidently on television and declared all his commitments with Iran null and void. Forty-five years later, with a 12-day imposed war, all these memories were revived for Iranians. This time, with America's green light, Benjamin Netanyahu, instead of Saddam, attacked Iran at a moment when indirect negotiations between Tehran and Washington were underway to supposedly resolve Iran's nuclear file peacefully. Now the entire world was waiting to see whether, just as Iranians under the guidance of their leader in the 8-year war with Saddam managed to force the enemy into accepting a ceasefire and defeat, in the second imposed war, the Israeli regime and its supporters would also be compelled to retreat or not. The Israeli regime's assessment was that, given Iran's chronic economic problems and social divisions after a lightning military strike, spontaneous protest cells would emerge, and what happened in Syria would be repeated in Iran as well. Thus, it was that June 13th marked the beginning of a difficult time for Iranians. According to the planners of this attack, with the assassination of high-ranking generals, the situation in Iran would become so chaotic that hired groups and counter-revolutionaries could seize control of parts of Tehran, such as Mehrabad Airport and its surrounding areas, from the police and security forces. This was deemed to cause the conditions through street chaos. Special forces would be airlifted into Iran, pushing the structure of Iran's government to the brink of collapse within a matter of days. The name of this operation had already been determined: True Promise 3. With operations True Promise 1 and 2, the IRGC in its first missile response did exactly what the regime had anticipated, using a large number of missiles so that the Israelis would feel assured that Iran's missile response pattern had not changed. The Israeli army assumed that by Iran's numerous launches, the locations of its missile systems would be exposed, and subsequently, under aerial strikes, another portion of the Islamic Republic's missile capability could be destroyed.
But we've not seen the pictures of it and been able to assess the nature of the damage because Israeli sensors have blocked that. But we also know that Iran hit and damaged, and in some cases destroyed, the Israel's version of the Pentagon, Israel's version of the CIA, Israel's version of the FBI, Israel's version of the National Security Agency. Israel has two seaports where containers come into the country and where exports leave the country. Iran shut those down. So wow. There was no more seatime, maritime traffic coming in and out of the port. Iran also destroyed the two oil refineries or interrupted their ability to process and produce fuel, the oil refineries at Haifa and Ashdod, which is also the places where the ports are located. Iran shut down the only international airport in Israel. So nobody was getting in and out of the country unless they went to a military airfield and got out on a military aircraft. But all of the military airfields in Israel were also hit.
It's more of a town, really, just on the outskirts of Tel Aviv, called Rishon LeZion. I am surrounded right now. If I look in every direction, there are a crew of about 12 emergency workers just in front of me now going patrolling houses everywhere around the streets here. There's the detritus of the strikes that happened at 5 a.m. this morning in this neighborhood. And just around the corner from me is what is now a crater, which used to be homes, where two people died.
But that was not the whole story. Israel's costly and expensive attacks carried out with repeated NATO aircraft refueling in the skies not only wore down equipment, but also imposed numerous financial, security, and logistical constraints on Israel and its allies. For this reason, contrary to the bluffs of the Zionist officials, this war was supposed to end very quickly with a decisive victory. Yet Iran, by changing its defensive tactics, decided that, contrary to the enemy's design, the war should become long and attritional, so that Israel would be punished by accepting defeat and a ceasefire would be dictated to them.
Yeah. Iran has stood up against it. Iran has the admiration and respect of the entire Arab world. The people in the Arab world that are not respected, that everybody loathes, are the ruling elites, because they are seen as eagerly selling everybody out for money and stability. So this war is going to continue for that reason. The other reason is that you can't leave Iran in place if you're an Israeli, because you've determined that they cannot be subjugated. If they can't be subjugated, if they won't submit to Israeli supremacy, inevitably they're going to come back and threaten Israel.
You get what Israel got, and basically, I don't know, they probably will not recover from this, at least in any time soon, if ever, actually. And you look attentively at some quarters of Tel Aviv or Beersheba, or it's just freaking like World War III then.
Iran's missile responses were so effective and unexpected that they quickly alarmed the West about Israel's imminent defeat.
Mouthies.
Thus, on the fourth and fifth days of the war, the leaders of the G7 gathered to take action in support of Israel. From that moment, it became clear that if the U.S. did not directly enter the field, Israel would be buried under the weight of Iran's missile strikes. For the White House, a strange situation arose. On the one hand, the fragile state of America's energy market, economy, and security was such that it could not enter into an intense war with Iran. On the other hand, it could not remain indifferent to the heavy blows that were pressuring its most important proxy force in the region. Therefore, in a historic gamble fraught with uncertainties, it decided to attack the nuclear facilities at Natanz, Fordo, and Isfahan. Immediately after this incident, Trump threatened Iran with consequences if it responded in any way and declared the time for a ceasefire and the end of the war had arrived.
And, you know, I listened to President Trump not too long ago say that Israel is winning. And, of course, this is the mantra in the mainstream media. But the question you have to ask yourself is, what does winning mean? It's a meaningless comment by itself.
If under these circumstances Iran had accepted a ceasefire, the United States would have succeeded in pulling Israel honorably out of the quagmire of war with Iran. But shortly after the U.S. Army's attack, Iran once again targeted Israeli-occupied territories with intense and devastating strikes. This time, the IRGC both changed its firing pattern and unleashed a large, energetic barrage upon Israel. Releasing images of widespread destruction in occupied territories evoked the Israeli army's assaults on Gaza. But the IRGC's missile campaign was not yet over. On the evening of June 23rd, the armed forces of the Islamic Republic carried out a precise attack named Bisharat al-Fath, glad tidings of victory, against the Al Udeid base in Qatar, using the same number of projectiles that the U.S. had employed in its strike on Iran's nuclear facilities. Although the Islamic Republic did not use its new generation missiles in this attack, the Americans, despite conducting the largest Patriot air defense operation in history, still failed to intercept all of the projectiles. In the end, 6 out of the 14 missiles launched hit their targets. The Al Udeid base in Qatar is considered the most valuable strategic asset of the U.S. military in the region, and serves as the headquarters of CENTCOM's Air Command. Alongside the operations True Promise 3 and Glad Tidings of Victory, the network of espionage and sabotage agents inside Iran, which had cost years of investment in training, equipping, and organizing, was being destroyed through vigilance of the people and the efforts of the Basij security and law enforcement forces. At the same time, the extraordinary cohesion of Iranians elevated the social capital of Iran to its highest point, and under the guidance of the commander-in-chief, public demands for punishing the aggressor grew stronger. Simultaneously, the measures of state officials to manage affairs and coordinate with the armed forces constantly conveyed to the world the message that Iran, united and in one voice, was ready for a long and powerful defense of its country. It was at this point that the regime had to find a solution for this dire situation. The intensity of the attacks and repeated crossing of red lines, such as targeting places like Evin Prison and medical centers on the 11th day, was for this reason.
Well, the thing you want to remember is that the Israelis depend very heavily on the idea or the notion that they have military superiority over everybody in the region, that they are invincible. And if they start a war and they lose that war, they don't win that war, and indeed it looks like Iran wins the war, this is a significant defeat for Israeli deterrence. It's just something that's almost unthinkable. They started this war thinking that they were going to win a relatively easy victory, and they were going to do to Iran what has been done to Syria. But that's not going to happen. The Iranians are going to stay in this fight. You want to remember that Iran fought against Iraq for 8 years, from 1980 to 1988.
Man, those days we were on Iraq's side, right?
That's correct. So the Iranians, I think, will stay in the fight. And I don't think Israel can maintain this fight over the long term.
By now, the enemies of the Iranian nation were grasping for breath, especially under the weight of global condemnations, which, with the fatwas of great religious authorities, such as Grand Ayatollah Sistani, further tightened the pressure on the U.S. and Zionist regime. If Iran's attacks on occupied territories had continued, if Iranian missiles had targeted other U.S. military bases in the region, if the oil and economic interests of the West had been damaged, if resistance groups in the region, who throughout these 12 days had kept their fingers on the trigger, such as Yemen, had entered the field, and if the energy economy and trade in the Persian Gulf had been disrupted, then what achievement would remain for the supporters of aggression against Iran? It was precisely for this reason that Washington, in a state of panic through intermediaries, proposed an immediate ceasefire to Iran. On June 23, 2025, the second imposed military war against the Islamic Republic of Iran came to an end after 12 days. Although from the very first hours of accepting the ceasefire proposed by the West, the war of narratives began, aiming to portray Israel and the U.S. as victors, awaken consciences, and above all, the people of the region and the Iranian nation knew who the true winner of Iran's struggle against the entire world of domination was.
It has taken Israel's high command just 12 days to see that total victory they claimed to have achieved in the first hours of their blitz on Iran turned something that looks much more like a strategic defeat. This 12-day war ended with none of Israel's three war aims being met. Trump's claim that Iran's nuclear enrichment program had been completely and fully obliterated has within a day been flatly contradicted by the intelligence arm of the Pentagon, who sent in the B-2 bombers.
The reason you had a 12-day war was first and foremost because the Israelis were running out of missiles, running out of the means to defend themselves.
Yeah.
Israel was being crushed in one barrage after another of very accurate and devastating missile fire from
Iran hasn't been defeated. In fact, Iran has punched back very hard against Israel, and Iran still has the ability to intimidate the United States.
But no, Israel is not a regional military hegemon and cannot dictate the future shape of the Middle East. The price it has had to pay is high. It has swapped Hamas's homegrown rockets for Iran's ballistic missiles. It has swapped an indirect enemy who uses proxies for a direct one, which has now no hesitation in keeping the entire population of Israel in its bunkers. Netanyahu's lifelong dream of slaying the Iranian dragon may have proved to be a bridge too far.
At the end of these 12 days, Israel not only failed to achieve its initial declared objectives of causing the collapse of Iran's governance, but the military power of Iran, which was supposed to be destroyed, turned into its bane. The U.S. success in destroying Iran's nuclear facilities was also met with serious doubt from experts due to the ambiguous and meaningful silence of the Iranian officials. Thus, the disgraceful and historic memory of the White House's cooperation with the aggression of the Israeli regime was this time etched into history with their failure to achieve their declared goals. Now, the Israeli regime, with its long list of war crimes, such as attacks on ambulances, rescue teams, and medical centers, assaults on scientific and research institutions, assassinations of scientists, intimidation of civilians, and attacks on media centers such as the IRIB and the Central Building of Islamic Radio and Television Union, awaits the consequences of what it has committed. And the U.S., with its lost prestige due to insults and offenses against diplomatic values, stands dishonored with its shattered grandeur at the hands of the Iranians. Meanwhile, along with the sense of pride and the rising spirit of sacrifice among the people, it is the flag of honor and dignity of the Islamic Republic of Iran that has been raised high through the readiness of its sons for struggle across the world, even though in this celebration of victory, we miss many great and small heroes of the homeland.
Can we not see how the planets look like diamonds in the sky? And everything on earth was created for you and I. Can we not see merely waiting for the final day to arrive? To arrive. Do we feel a deeper meaning to it all? And in our creation, there are no flaws, and we're trying to control something we can't explain. Or we wander around blindly in the dark without an aim. Do we think it's all a game?
Yeah.
like smiling at your fellow man, or looking up at the velvet sky. And sometimes it makes me wonder why we're all still here. Do we feel a deeper meaning? Think it's all a game? Do we think it's all a game? Do we think it's all a game? Do we think it's all a game?
Thank you for joining us. The repercussions of the clashes in the Syrian town of Beijing, the escalating Israeli aggression against Lebanon, and the discussion taking place regarding the possibility of launching a war on Hezbollah, in addition to the issue of Palestinian resistance fighters in the Rafah tunnels. These topics will be the area of discussions in this episode with Mr. Khaled Barakat, writer and political researcher, joining us here in the studio. Hello and welcome, Mr. Khaled.
Thank you, Farah.
The Israeli assault on the town of Beijing in the countryside of Damascus and the residents' confrontation with Israeli forces were the focus of many commentaries in the Hebrew media, which emphasized the need to maintain the occupation of Syrian territory. What's your opinion on what the Israeli commentator said that the forces, of course, he's saying that they should strengthen their own position inside Syria and not withdraw from it?
This just reflects the Israeli arrogance and the Israeli aggression. I mean, they have been bombing Syria regularly without any retaliation or even resistance.
Yes.
in Syria. But the Israelis are really surprised that there was a resistance because they tried to advance in the Syrian territory. So this is a colonizer who is shocked that the indigenous people of Syria are fighting back. They think that they can have a free hand in Syria and our region without any resistance. And in my view, we are going to witness an escalation in resistance in Syria on the borders, in the Syrian-Palestinian borders, against Israeli occupiers who have been advancing in Syrian land. And we are going to see this by Syrian popular resistance and armed resistance by the people of Syria. They have been seeing what Israel have been doing. And, more and more the Syrian public have been aware and there is an anger among Syrians.
Okay. But the major question asked here, Mr. Khaled, is that how would these incidents, whether the resistance, the appearance of the resistance, and the Israeli continuation and deliberate act to control lands in Syria, affect the talks between Netanyahu and al-Julani?
Right. I think that
with an American umbrella, under the American umbrella.
Absolutely. I mean, Israel doesn't want to give anything. They don't want to withdraw from Syrian land. They have been occupying the Golan Heights for, since 1967. And Trump said that he have given Golan Heights to Israel as a gift. I mean, this guy is worse than Balfour himself. And at the same time, we see that the people of Syria are actually being more and more aware of Israeli attempts and Israeli, plans on Syria. They want to plunder Syrian water, strategic areas like Jabal al-Sheikh, and elsewhere. But the most important thing is now this discourse is about the so-called extreme Sunnis. Extreme Sunnis for Zionists now is those who fight Israel back. You know, ISIS is not an extreme Sunnis. You know, these terrorist groups that have been killing Syrians bombing,
yes.
Civilians.
Yes.
They are not extreme Sunnis. Extreme
okay.
Sunnis is the one who fight Israel.
Yes, but would it have an impact on the talks that are yet to be held and is being held under the table with an American support between Al-Junani and Netanyahu?
We are going to see.
These resistance, the appearance of the popular Syrian resistance.
You see, Farah, we are going to see two camps in Syria, just like we have two camps in Palestine and in Lebanon. Those who support the resistance and the liberation of their land, and those who are puppets to U.S. imperialism and to Israel. And we are going to see that this is imminent. It's not going to be like, because what does Syrian get out of a so-called peace accord?
So the talks are going to continue.
It's going to collapse.
It's going to collapse.
Absolutely. And if there is new Syrian regime going to have an... any kind of pact or, with Israel, it's mm-hmm. going to be a surrender to Israel.
Okay.
It's going to be a submission to Israel.
What is happening in Syria? Well, and Lebanon has pushed Iran to make an effort to deliver combat equipment to both countries and to Yemen as well to confront any new war that the Israelis may launch against Lebanon. According to this Israeli military commentator in the Hebrew media, how credible are these claims against Iran, that Iran is sending weapons to Syria, Lebanon, and Yemen? And what is the purpose of such allegations?
I mean, the Israelis are living in bubble, and they don't know how to leave this bubble. In fact, she made a mistake by saying, and they're supporting the Syrian regime, because they're used to saying these things in the past. And so it's in their mindset. That Iran is arming, everyone. First of all, Iran public declared position that they support the resistance is something Iran is not shying away from.
Okay.
And so, but when they say that, they're repeating the Israeli propaganda that the problem in the region is Iran, and that these resistance, whether in Palestine, Lebanon, Syria, Iraq, Yemen, they're just arms of Iran, proxies of Iran. And this is really have been exposed, internationally, that it is not true, and that the resistance in the region is one camp, but different components of it. Mm-hmm. And the decisions that it's made is completely.
So what's the purpose of forcing such allegations and implementing them, whether in the Hebrew media or even into Western media?
Because they're trying to build a camp against Iran, not just in, Israeli camp against Iran, but also regional camp against Iran. Their eyes is fixed on threatening Iran, besieging Iran, imposing conditions, economic sanctions, and even war.
That's why I refer to Yemen to recruit Saudi Arabia.
Absolutely. And Saudis are actually, the Saudi regime have been launching aggressions against people in Saba regularly lately. Mm-hmm. And, I don't know what kind of commitment they got from the Saudi regime during the visit of Mohammed bin Salman to Washington, especially on the, deal of F-35 and these kind of, agreements between U.S. and Saudi Arabia. But I think that this is a rhetoric that we have been hearing for years.
Okay. Turning to Lebanon, the Hebrew media, of course, revealed the outcome of the security discussions that took place between the prime minister, the ministers, and the chief of staff regarding Lebanon following the recent aggression on the southern suburb of Beirut and the assassination of the martyr Tabtabai. According to what was revealed by the Hebrew media, the outcome of the Israeli security discussions regarding Lebanon boils down to the continuation of these attacks under an American green light. What do you see of this?
I think that the Israelis are divided, and I have been reading some of the Israeli military strategists who have been actually saying this out, directly, saying that there is a division within the Israeli military, ranks of how to deal with Lebanon. There are those who are pushing for a full-scale war, mm-hmm. and those who are saying we can maybe escalate, but to a limit.
From the Israeli perspective, you're speaking,
yes.
Not the American one.
The Israelis.
Okay.
The Israelis. And I think that they are having a green light from the U.S., even if Israel escalates in Lebanon, because we know that the aggression against Lebanon is a U.S. aggression to begin with. This is really something that we cannot stress enough, to say that all of these...
But Trump's presenting himself that he wants peace in the Middle East,
yeah,
and that Lebanon has a special dimension to it, different from Palestine.
But
it does not seem that the Americans really want to do this.
Yeah, but if he doesn't want to do this, he won't give ultimatum to Lebanon, saying December 31st, if you don't disarm, Hezbollah, then, there will be trouble. And then this is Trump rhetoric. But
so do you expect a full-scale war?
I don't think so. And the reason why I don't think that a full-scale war will happen is because Israel wants to keep the Lebanese public in this dilemma. Is there a war? Maybe there is no war. And at the same time, make everyone, worries. And so people are delaying their even personal plans,
Okay, yes.
And so at the same time, when you ask today in the Lebanese, public, they don't want to see a war. The vast majority of Lebanese don't want to see a war. But at the same time, Israel understands that a full-scale war means that all the efforts they did in the north in resettling their settlers are going to be just collapsing.
Okay.
And that the resistance is ready, and it's,
yes.
Have been declaring that if an aggression, especially land, invasions,
yes.
Lebanon,
okay, but Mr. Khaled, how do you read the timing of the Pope visit to Lebanon? Would it make the war less likely, the large-scale war by Israel on Lebanon?
Israel doesn't care about the Pope. This is the last thing in their mind. They actually don't like his statements about even the two-state solution. And they're just refraining from criticizing the Pope because they know that, they might lose more on international, front. But at the same time, we see that Israel is more and more isolated.
Yes, but the visit shows that the Lebanon has a special place.
It is.
For Christians, especially.
Absolutely.
Yes. Why wouldn't that cause more pressure on Israel if a large-scale war is to be done?
And we want the Pope also to recognize that Palestinians, a great portion of our people, are Christians, and that Christ himself was Palestinian, and that Israel kills Christians every, regularly in
churches.
Palestine, and attack churches, and steal, sites by Palestinian Christians. And it is really important for the Pope to actually see that these crimes, and genocide, Israel cannot get away with it. I mean, they destroy four historical churches in Gaza. They have killed and injured and, displaced, the vast majority of Christians in Gaza.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's absolutely known now to, if I may use the Christians, across the globe, that Israel is a genocidal regime, that Israel is very dangerous to Muslims and Christians in our region.
But yet it's harshly been criticized.
Actually, there is a division. There are hundreds of churches across the globe.
Okay.
They understand what Israel is all about.
The issue of the presence of Palestinian resistance fighters in the Rafah tunnels in the Gaza Strip continues to draw media attention in the Israeli entity, especially as it comes amid calls within the entity to deal with them by military means. Do you think that the issue of the Palestinian resistance fighters in Rafah will take a political path
or only a military path?
I think what Israel wants to do is to create an image where they are victorious. They have been proposing for fighters to come out with white flags to submit their arms. Behind the doors, and I know this solid information, it's not analysis, that the Israelis just wanted to have this image of Palestinian fighters surrendering. And they cannot get this image. They have been trying to get this, you know, victory image for over 2 years, and they couldn't. And so the resistance is not going to give them now this opportunity. And that's why they're upset. That's why they're angry. They're angry because, yes, they detained some of them. They killed some of them. They don't respect, you know, we're supposed to have a ceasefire, and yet they are bombing.
And they made promises that these tunnels has been conquered to their own people, and now they're in another position. To what extent do you believe that there is Israeli fear of the resistance fighters and the possibility of that they could attack the occupation forces that are next to the tunnels or close to the tunnels?
These fighters were there in the in these positions because they were in the advanced positions. Basically, they're fighters who have been determined to fight until the last bullet. So they will not surrender. Israeli army are afraid of getting closer and closer to some of these tunnels. The Palestinian resistance in Gaza is willing to fight if, you know, any Israeli intrusion comes to the tunnels. These tunnels are completely full of explosives. If Israelis, soldiers or, you know, battalions try to infiltrate in these tunnels, they will go into face consequences.
Okay.
And they're trying to do it slowly, the Israelis, but surely. At the same time, you know, I mean, some of the Hamas leaders' sons have been killed recently in these tunnels. So they're trying to, Israel trying to put pressure on the negotiating team of Hamas to say that, you know, we will, you know, use this as a pressure point to get more concessions from the resistance.
Okay. However, Israeli social media reacted to the ongoing Israeli aggression against the occupied West Bank, and here are some of the comments.
News 24. Five Stones is the name of the operation launched by army forces in Judea and Samaria, the West Bank, to thwart terrorist acts there. Shlomo Reichman. Terrorism in Judea and Samaria, the West Bank, has become organized and systematic. There are battalions with command and control that threaten the Israeli army's freedom of action in the area. Adi Rotem, Finance Minister Smotrich has no interest in the economy. All that matters to him is the gradual annexation of Judea and Samaria, the West Bank.
And regarding the disagreements between Israeli Minister of War, Israel Katz, and Chief of Staff Eyal Zamir, which continue to dominate political and media debates within the Israeli entity over who bears responsibility for the emergence of these disagreements at this time. One of the most notable aspects to these agreements is that they are occurring amid a militarily and politically aggressive trajectory, whether in Lebanon, in Gaza, or even in Syria. What does this indicate?
It indicates, again, that the Israeli don't have a strategy. They have a might supported by the United States. They are bombing, but they cannot have really... what's the end game? What do they want from Syria? What do they want from Lebanon, from Gaza? If you ask them this question...
Greater Israel.
Yes, but that's what Netanyahu says, you know, out you know, in the open. But really...
They don't have a plan, you're saying?
What I mean is that, I mean, this is a war criminal who's wanted by the International Criminal, you know,
court. Yes.
And at the same time, Israel is isolated. We need to always remember that Israel today is not Israel before October 7th. And, you know, these kind of policies and positions and fractions, it just indicates not Israel's strength, but Israel weakens, you know. And I just give you two quick examples. One, we have been seeing